This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joy Chan. Mysticism, A Study in Nature and Development of Spiritual Consciousness by Evelyn Underhill. Second half of Part 2, Chapter 2. The conversion of Merswin's greater contemporary, Suso, seems to have been less abrupt. Of its first stage he speaks vaguely at the beginning of his autobiography, wherein he says that he began to be converted when in the 18th year of his age. He was at this time, as St. Francis had been, restless, dissatisfied, vaguely conscious of something essential to his peace as yet unfound. His temperament, at once deeply human and ardently spiritual, passionately appreciative of sensuous beauty, yet unable to rest in it, had not unified itself. Nor did it do so completely until after a period of purgation, which is probably unequalled for its austerity in the history of the mysticism of the West. He was kept of God in this, that when he turned to those things that most enticed him, he found neither happiness nor peace therein. He was restless, and it seemed to him that something which was as yet unknown could alone give peace to his heart, and he suffered greatly of this restlessness. God at last delivered him by a complete conversion. His brothers in religion were astonished by so quick a change, for the event took them unawares. Some said of it one thing and some another, but none could know the reason of his conversion. It was God who, by a hidden light, had caused this return to himself. This secret conversion was completed by a more violent uprush of the now awakened and active transcendental powers. Suso, whom one can imagine as a great and highly nervous artist if his genius had not taken the channel of sanctity instead, was subject all his life to visions of peculiar richness and beauty. Often these visions seemed to have floated up, as it were, from the subliminal region without disturbing the course of his conscious life, and to be little more than pictorial images of his ardour towards and intuition of divine realities. The great ecstatic vision, or rather apprehension, with which the series opens, however, is of a very different kind, and represents the characteristic experience of ecstasy in its fullest form. It is described with a detail and intensity which make it a particularly valuable document of the mystical life. It is doubtful whether Suso ever saw more than this. The course of his long education, rather, consisted in an adjustment of his nature to the reality which he then perceived. In the first days of his conversion, it happened upon the feast of St. Agnes, when the convent had breakfasted at midday, that the servitor went into the choir. He was alone, and he placed himself in the last stall on the prior's side, and he was in much suffering, for a heavy trouble weighed upon his heart, and being there alone and devoid of all consolations, no one by his side, no one near him, of a sudden his soul was wrapped in his body, or out of his body. Then did he see and hear that which no tongue can express. That which the servitor saw had no form, neither any manner of being, yet he had of it a joy such as he might have known in the seeing of the shapes and substances of all joyful things. His heart was hungry yet satisfied. His soul was full of contentment and joy. His prayers and hopes were all fulfilled, and the friar could do naught but contemplate this shining brightness, and he altogether forgot himself and all other things. Was it day or night? He knew not. It was, as it were, a manifestation of the sweetness of eternal life in the sensations of silence and of rest. Then he said, "If that which I see and feel be not the kingdom of heaven, I know not what it can be, for it is very sure that the endurance of all possible pains were but a poor price to pay for the eternal possession of so great a joy." The physical accompaniments of ecstasy were also present. This ecstasy lasted from half an hour to an hour, and whether his soul were in the body or out of the body he could not tell. But when he came to his senses, it seemed to him that he returned from another world. And so greatly did his body suffer in this short rapture, that it seemed to him that none, even in dying, could suffer so greatly in so short a time. The servitor came to himself moaning, and he fell down upon the ground like a man who swoons. And he cried inwardly, heaving great sighs from the depth of his soul, and saying, O my God, where was I, and where am I? And again, O my heart's joy, never shall my soul forget this hour. He walked, but it was but his body that walked, as a machine might do. None knew from his demeanour that which was taking place within, but his soul and his spirit were full of marvels. Heavenly lightnings passed and repassed in the deeps of his being, and it seemed to him that he walked on air. And all the powers of his soul were full of these heavenly delights. He was like a vase from which one has taken a precious ointment, but in which the perfume long remains. Finally, the last phrases of the chapter seem to suggest the true position of this exalted pleasure state as a first link in the long chain of mystical development. This foretaste of the happiness of heaven, he says, the which the servitor enjoyed for many days, excited in him a most lively desire for God. Mystical activity, then, like all other activities of the self, opens with that sharp stimulation of the will, which can only be obtained through the emotional life. Suso was a scholar and an embryo ecclesiastic. During the period which elapsed between his conversion and his description of it, he was a disciple of Meister Eckhart, a student of Dionysius and St. Thomas Aquinas. His writings show familiarity with the categories of mystical theology, and naturally enough this circumstance, and also the fact that they were written for purposes of edification, may have dictated to some extent the language in which his conversion ecstasy is described. As against this, I will give two first-hand descriptions of mystical conversion, in which it is obvious that theological learning plays little or no part. Both written in France within a few years of one another, they represent the impact of reality on two minds of very different calibre. One is the secret document in which a great genius set down, in words intended only for his own eyes, the record of a 2 hours' ecstasy. The other is the plain, unvarnished statement of an uneducated man of the peasant class. The first is, of course, the celebrated memorial or amulet of Pascal. The second is the relation of Brother Lawrence. The memorial of Pascal is a scrap of parchment on which, round a rough drawing of the flaming cross, there are written a few strange phrases, abrupt and broken words. All we know about one of the strangest ecstatic revelations chronicled in the history of the mystic type. After Pascal's death, a servant found a copy of this little document, now lost, sewn up in his doublet. He seems always to have worn it upon his person, a perpetual memorial of the supernal experience, the initiation into reality which it describes. Though Brémond has shown that the opening of Pascal's spiritual eyes had begun, on his own declaration, 11 months earlier, de manière douce et obligeante, the conversion thus prepared was only made actual by this abrupt illumination, ending a long period of spiritual stress, in which indifference to his ordinary interests was counterbalanced by an utter inability to feel the attractive force of that divine reality which his great mind discerned as the only adequate object of desire. The memorial opens thus. L'an de grâce 1654, lundi 25 novembre, jour de Saint-Clement, pape et martre, et autres au martre-loge, veille de Saint-Crozon-Ronde, martre et autres depuis environ 10h30, du soir jusqu'à environ minuit et demi, feu. From 10:30 till 12:30, fire. That is all so far as description is concerned, but enough apparently to remind the initiate of all that passed. The rest tells us only the passion of joy and conviction which this nameless revelation, this long blazing vision of reality, brought in its train. It is but a series of amazed exclamations, crude, breathless words, placed there helter-skelter, the artist in him utterly in abeyance, the names of the overpowering emotions which swept him one after the other, as the fire of love disclosed its secrets, evoked an answering flame of humility and rapture in his soul. Dieu d'Abraham, Dieu d'Isaac, Dieu de Jacob, nom des philosophes et des savants, certitude, certitude,
sentiment, joy, paix.
Not the god of all philosophers and of scholars, cries in amazement this great scholar and philosopher abruptly turned from knowledge to love.
Oublie du monde, et de tout homme dieu, he says again, seeing his universe suddenly swept clean of all but this transcendent fact.
Then, le monde ne t'a point connu, mais je t'ai connu. Joy, 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 pleure de joy. Compare with the classic style, the sharp and lucid definition of the pensée, the irony and glitter of the provincial, these little broken phrases, this childlike stammering speech, in which a supreme master of language has tried to tell his wonder and his delight. I know few things in the history of mysticism at once more convincing, more poignant than this hidden talisman, upon which the brilliant scholar and stylist, the merciless disputant, has jotted down in hard, crude words, which yet seem charged with passion, the inarticulate language of love, a memorial of the certitude, the peace, the joy, above all, the reiterated all-surpassing joy which accompanied his ecstatic apprehension of God. Mon Dieu, me quitterez-vous, he says again, the fire apparently beginning to die down, the ecstasy drawing to an end.
Que je n'en sois pas séparé éternellement.
Are you going to leave me? Oh, let me not be separated from you forever. The one unendurable thought which would, said Aquinas, rob the beatific vision of its glory, were we not sure that it can never fade. But the rhapsody is over, the vision of the fire has gone, and the rest of the memorial clearly contains Pascal's meditations upon his experience, rather than a transcript of the experience itself. It ends with the watchword of all mysticism, surrender.
Renonciation totale et douce,
in Pascal's words, the only way, he thinks, in which he can avoid continued separation from reality. Pascal's vision of light, life, and love was highly ecstatic, an indescribable, incommunicable experience, which can only be suggested by his broken words of certitude and joy. By his simple contemporary, Brother Lawrence, that transcendent reality who is not the god of philosophers and scholars, was perceived in a moment of abrupt intuition, peculiarly direct, unecstatic, and untheological in type, but absolutely enduring in its results. Lawrence was an uneducated young man of the peasant class, who first served as a soldier and afterwards as a footman in a great French family, where he annoyed his masters by breaking everything. When he was between 50 and 60 years of age, he entered the Carmelite order as a lay brother, and the letters, spiritual maxims, and conversations belonging to this period of his life were published after his death in 1691. He told me, says the anonymous reporter of the conversations, supposed to be Monsieur Beaufort, who was about 1660 grand vicar to the Cardinal de Noailles, that God had done him a singular favour in his conversion at the age of 18, that in the winter, seeing a tree stripped of its leaves, and considering that within a little time the leaves would be renewed, and after that the flowers and fruit appear, he received a high view of the providence and power of God, which has never since been effaced from his soul, that this view has set him perfectly loose from the world, and kindled in him such a love for God, that he could not tell whether it had increased in above 40 years that he had lived since. Such use of visible nature as the stuff of ontological perceptions, the medium whereby the self reaches out to the absolute, is not rare in the history of mysticism. The mysterious vitality of trees, the silent magic of the forest, the strange and steady cycle of its life, possess in a peculiar degree this power of unleashing the human soul, are curiously friendly to its cravings, minister to its inarticulate needs. Unsullied by the corroding touch of consciousness, that life can make a contact with the great life of the all, and through its mighty rhythms man can receive a message concerning the true and timeless world of all that is and was and evermore shall be. Plant life of all kinds, indeed, from the flower in the crannied wall to the woods of Westermain, can easily become, for selves of a certain type, a mode of the infinite.
So obvious does this appear when we study the history of the mystics, that Steiner has drawn from it the hardly warrantable inference that plants are just those natural phenomena whose qualities in the higher world are similar to their qualities in the physical world. Though the conclusion be not convincing, the fact remains. The flowery garment of the world is for some mystics a medium of ineffable perception, a source of exalted joy, the veritable clothing of God. I need hardly add that such a state of things has always been found incredible by common sense. The tree which moves some to tears of joy, says Blake, who possessed in an eminent degree this form of sacramental perception, is in the eyes of others only a green thing that stands in the way. Such a perception of the divine in nature, of the true and holy meaning of that rich, unresting life in which we are immersed, is really a more usual feature of illumination than of conversion. All the most marked examples of it must be referred to that state, and will be discussed when we come to its consideration. Sometimes, however, as in the case of Brother Lawrence, the first awakening of the self to consciousness of reality does take this form. The uncreated light manifests itself in and through created things. This characteristically immanental discovery of the absolute occurs chiefly in two classes: in unlettered men who have lived close to nature, and to whom her symbols are more familiar than those of the churches or the schools, and in temperaments of the mixed or mystical type, who are nearer to the poet than to the true contemplative, for whom as a rule the absolute hath no image. It was like entering into another world, a new state of existence, says a witness quoted by Starbuck, speaking of his own conversion. Natural objects were glorified. My spiritual vision was so clarified that I saw beauty in every material object in the universe. The woods were vocal with heavenly music. Oh, how I was changed! Everything became new. My horses and hogs and everybody became changed, exclaims with naive astonishment another in the same collection. When I went in the morning into the fields to work, says a third, the glory of God appeared in all his visible creation. I well remembered we reaped oats, and how every straw and head of the oats seemed, as it were, arrayed in a kind of rainbow glory, or to glow, if I may so express it, in the glory of God. Amongst modern men, Walt Whitman possessed in a supreme degree the permanent sense of this glory, the light rare, untellable, lighting the very light. But evidences of its existence and the sporadic power of apprehending it are scattered up and down the literature of the world. Its discovery constitutes the awakening of the mystical consciousness in respect of the world of becoming, a sharp and sudden break with the old and obvious way of seeing things. The human cinematograph has somehow changed its rhythm, and begins to register new and more real aspects of the external world. With this, the self's first escape from the limitations of its conventional universe, it receives an immense assurance of a great and veritable life surrounding, sustaining, explaining its own. Thus Richard Jefferies says, of the same age as that at which Suso and Brother Lawrence awoke to sudden consciousness of reality, I was not more than 18 when an inner and esoteric meaning began to come to me from all the visible universe. I now became lost and absorbed into the being or existence of the universe, and losing thus my separateness of being, came to seem like a part of the whole. I feel on the margin of a life unknown, very near, almost touching it, on the verge of powers which, if I could grasp, would give men an immense breadth of existence. What was this life unknown, but the life known to the great mystics, which Richard Jefferies apprehended in these moments of insight, yet somehow contrived to miss? Such participation in the deep realities of the world of becoming, the boundless existence of a divine whole, which a modern psychologist has labelled and described as cosmic consciousness, whilst it is not the final object of the mystic's journey, is a constant feature of it. It may represent one half of his characteristic consciousness, an entrance into communion with the second of the triune powers of God, the Word which is through all things everlastingly. Jefferies stood, as so many mystically minded men have done, upon the verge of such a transcendental life. The heavenly door, as Roll calls it, was ajar but not pushed wide. he peeped through it to the greater world beyond, but, unable to escape from the bonds of his selfhood, he did not pass through to live upon the independent spiritual plane. Roll, Geoffrey's fellow countryman, and his predecessor by close upon 600 years in the ecstatic love and understanding of natural things, shall be our last example of the mystical awakening. He, like his spiritual brother St. Francis and other typical cases, had passed through a preliminary period of struggle and oscillation between worldly life and a vague but growing spirituality, between the superficial and the deeper self. My youth was fond, my childhood vain, my young age unclean. But when I should flourish unhappily, and youth of wakeful age has now come, the grace of my Maker was near, the which lust of temporal shape restrained, and unto ghostly supplications turned my desires, and the soul from low things lifted to heaven was born. The real life-changing, however, was sharply and characteristically marked off from his preparatory state. Roll associates it with the state which he calls heat, the form in which his ardour of soul was translated to the surface consciousness. Heat soothly I call when the mind truly is kindled in love everlasting, and the heart on the same manner to burn not hopingly but verily is felt. The heart truly turned into fire gives feeling of burning love. This burning heat is not merely a mental experience. In it we seem to have an unusual but not unique form of psychophysical parallelism, a bodily expression of the psychic travail and distress accompanying the new birth. "More have I marvelled than I show, forsooth," he says in his prologue, "when I first felt my heart wax warm, and truly, not imaginingly, but as it were with a sensible fire, burned. I was forsooth marvelled, as this burning burst up in my soul, and of an unwonted solace. For in my ignorance of such healing abundance, oft have I groped my breast, seeing whether this burning were of any bodily cause outwardly. But when I knew that only it was kindled of ghostly cause inwardly, and this burning was naught of fleshly love or desire, in this I conceived it was the gift of my Maker." Further on, he gives another and more detailed account. "From the beginning, forsooth, of my life changing and of my mind, to the opening of the heavenly door which thy face showed, that the heart might behold heavenly things, and see by what way its love it might seek and busily desire, 3 years are run except 3 months or four. The door, forsooth, biding open, a year nearby I passed unto the time in which the heat of love everlasting was verily felt in heart. I sat, forsooth, in a chapel, and whilst with sweetness of prayer and meditation greatly I was delighted, suddenly in me I felt a merry heat and unknown. But at first I wondered, doubting of whom it should be, but a long time I am assured that not of the creature but of my Maker it was, for more hot and gladder I found it." To this we must add a passage which I cannot but think one of the most beautiful expressions of spiritual joy to be found in mystical literature, based though it certainly is upon a passage of St. Augustine, for the nightingale's not a Yorkshire bird. Its sketch of the ideal mystic life, to the cultivation of which he then set himself, reveals in a few lines the most charming aspect of Roll's spirituality, its poetic fervour, its capacity for ardent love. "In the beginning truly of my conversion and singular purpose, I, though I would be like the little bird that for love of her lover longs, but in her longing she is gladdened when he comes that she loves. And joying she sings, and singing she longs, but in sweetness and heat." It is said the nightingale to song and melody all night is given, that she may please him to whom she is joined. How much more with greatest sweetness to Christ my Jesus should I sing, that is spouse of my soul by all this present life, that is night in regard of clearness to come. Glancing back at the few cases here brought together, we can see in them, I think, certain similarities and diversities which are often of great psychological interest and importance, and have their influence upon the subsequent development of the mystic life. We see in particular at this point, before purification or the remaking of character begins, the reaction of the natural self, its heart and its mind, upon that uprush of new truth which operates mystical conversion. This reaction is highly significant, and gives us a clue not only to the future development of the mystic, but to the general nature of man's spiritual consciousness. We have said that this consciousness in its full development seems to be extended not in one, but in two directions. These directions, these two fundamental ways of apprehending reality, may be called the eternal and temporal, transcendent and immanent, absolute and dynamic aspects of truth. They comprise the twofold knowledge of a God who is both being and becoming, near and far, pairs of opposites which the developed mystical experience will carry up into a higher synthesis. But the first awakening of the mystic sense, the first breaking in of the suprasensible upon the soul, commonly involves the emergence of one only of these complementary forms of perception. One side always wakes first, the incoming message always choosing the path of least resistance. Hence mystical conversion tends to belong to one of two distinctive types, tends also, as regards its expression, to follow that temperamental inclination to objectivize reality as a place, a person, or a state which we found to govern the symbolic systems of the mystics. There is first, then, the apprehension of a splendor without, an expansive, formless, ineffable vision, a snatching up of the self, as it were, from knowledge of this world to some vague yet veritable knowledge of the next. The veil parts, and the Godhead is perceived as transcendent to, yet immanent in, the created universe. Not the personal touch of love transfiguring the soul, but the impersonal glory of a transfigured world, is the dominant note of this experience. And the reaction of the self takes the form of awe and rapture, rather than of intimate affection. Of such a kind was the conversion of Suso, and in a less degree of Brother Lawrence. Of this kind also were the light which Rollman Mersman saw, and the mystical perception of the being of the universe reported by Richard Jefferies and countless others. This experience, if it is to be complete, if it is to involve the definite emergence of the self from the prison of I-hood, its setting out upon the mystic way, requires an act of concentration on the self's part as the complement of its initial act of expansion. It must pass beyond the stage of metaphysical rapture or fluid splendor and crystallize into a willed response to the reality perceived. A definite and personal relation must be set up between the self and the absolute life. To be a spectator of reality is not enough. The awakened subject is not merely to perceive transcendent life, but to participate therein, and for this a drastic and costly life-changing is required. In Jeffrey's case, this crystallization, this heroic effort towards participation, did not take place, and he never, therefore, laid hold of the glory that has been revealed. In Suso's it did, exciting in him a most lively desire for God. In most cases, this crystallization, the personal and imperative concept which the mind constructs from the general and ineffable intuition of reality, assumes a theological character. Often it presents itself to the consciousness in the form of visions or voices, objective as the crucifix which spoke to St. Francis, or mental as the visions of the cross experienced by Rollman Mersman and St. Catherine of Genoa. Nearly always, this concept, this intimate realization of the divine, has reference to the love and sorrow at the heart of things, the discord between perfect love and an imperfect world. Whereas the complementary vision of transcendence strikes a note of rapturous joy. The beatings of the heart of God sounded like so many invitations which thus spake, "Come and do penance, come and be reconciled, come and be consoled, come and be blessed. Come, my love, and receive all that the beloved can give to his beloved. Come, my bride, and enjoy my Godhead." It is to this personal touch, to the individual appeal of an immediate presence, not to the great light and the beatific vision, that the awakened self makes its most ardent, most heroic response, not because he was rapt from himself, but because the figure on the cross called him by name, saying, "Repair my church," did St. Francis, with that simplicity, that disregard of worldly values which constituted his strength, accept the message in a literal sense, and set himself instantly to the work demanded, bringing stones and, in defiance alike of comfort and convention, building up with his own hands the crumbling walls. In many conversions to the mystic life, the revelation of external splendour, the shining vision of the transcendent spiritual world, is wholly absent. The self awakes to that which is within, rather than to that which is without, to the immanent, not the transcendent, God, to the personal, not the cosmic relation. Where those who look out receive the revelation of divine beauty, those who look in receive rather the wound of divine love. Another aspect of the triple star. Emotional mystics such as Richard Roll and Madame Guyon give us this experience in an extreme form. We find in St. Catherine of Genoa a nobler example of the same type of response. That inward revelation in its anguish and abruptness, its rending apart of the hard tissues of I-hood and vivid disclosures of the poverty of the finite self, seemed, says the legend of St. Catherine, the wound of unmeasured love, an image in which we seem to hear the very accents of the saint. A wound full of delight, says the effusive Madame Guyon. I wished that it might never heal. Roll calls this piercing rapture a great heat, the heat which is to light the fire of love. As it were, if the finger were put in fire, it should be clad with feeling of burning, so the soul with love, as aforesaid, set afire, truly feels most very heat. Love, passionate and all-dominant, here takes the place of that joyous awe which we noticed as the characteristic reaction upon reality in conversions of the transcendent type. In the deep and strong temperaments of the great mystics, this love passes quickly, sometimes instantly, from the emotional to the volitional stage. Their response to the voice of the Absolute is not merely an effusion of sentiment, but an act of will, an act often of so deep and comprehensive a kind as to involve the complete change of the outward, no less than of the inward life. Divine love, says Dionysius, draws those whom it seizes beyond themselves, and this so greatly that they belong no longer to themselves, but wholly to the object loved. Merswin's oath of self-surrender, St. Catherine of Genoa's passionate and decisive, "No more world, no more sins," St. Francis's naive and instant devotion to church restoration in its most literal sense. These things are earnests of the reality of the change. They represent, symbolize as well as they can upon the sensual plane, the spontaneous response of the living organism to a fresh external stimulus, its first effort of adjustment to the new conditions which that stimulus represents. They complete the process of conversion, which is not one-sided, not merely an infusion into the surface consciousness of new truth, but rather the beginning of a life process, a breaking down of the old and building up of the new. A never-to-be-ended give-and-take is set up between the individual and the absolute. The spirit of life has been born, and the first word it learns to say is Abba, Father. It aspires to its origin, to life in its most intense manifestation. Hence all its instincts urge it to that activity which it feels to be inseparable from life. It knows itself a member of that mighty family in which the stars are numbered, the family of the sons of God, who, free and creative, sharing the rapture of a living, striving cosmos, shout for joy. So even in its very beginning, we see how active, how profoundly organic, how deeply and widely alive is the true contemplative life. How truly on the transcendent as on the phenomenal plane, the law of living things is action and reaction, force and energy. The awakening of the self is to a new and more active plane of being, new and more personal relations with reality, hence to a new and more real work which it must do. End of Part 2, Chapter 2.